This week on Retronauts, what kind of world-class author can't spell cemetery anyway? Hello, boys and ghouls, and welcome to Retronauts. I'm your host for this week, Nadia Oxford, also the co-host of the Axe That Blog RPG podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm here to talk about horror author Stephen King's influence on video games, but I'm sure not going to do that alone because that's some scary shit right there. So joining me are my good friends, Andrew Vestal and Shane Bettenhausen. Say hi, fellow Overlook caretakers, and introduce yourselves briefly. You first, Andrew.
Hi there. My name is Andrew Vestal. I have a long and storied history in the RPG corners of the gaming internet, and I'm also an inveterate book nerd who has read a lot of Stephen King in my childhood.
That's probably what twisted us all in the end, as we'll get into.
So. Yeah, the whole point of Stephen King is that you have to read him when you're like in fourth grade and should absolutely not be reading Stephen King. That's the ideal age to come to his work.
Oh, absolutely. Like my mom, like, oh no, you can't watch violence on TV, but read all the Stephen King you want. Yeah, hell no, you're not my daughter if you don't read Stephen King. You imbue this book, you get out of my house. That was my childhood.
I'm parenting my daughter the same way. I told her she couldn't watch season two of Demon Slayer because it was too violent, but she's allowed to read the manga, and she's reading. So, you know,
whatever
it takes to encourage your children to stick their nose in a book.
I'm sorry to drown you out, Shane. You say hi.
Oh, greetings, constant readers. This is Shane Bettenhausen. I've been on the Retronauts here and there occasionally, and once in a while on Axe of the Blood Gods.
Yes, so you are.
Happy to be here for a fun, obscure, interesting topic that's kind of outside the normal purview of Retronauts.
Yeah, this topic in general, this is something I've been kind of had a bug up my butt about doing for a long time now. And I threatened to do it recently in a previous show, saying that if I needed a kind of a rainy day topic, this would be it. Well, guess what? I needed a rainy day topic. And here we are, because as someone like the two of you who has been reading Stephen King since a very young age, you start to notice certain parallels going on between, not even parallels, I guess like intersections between both the mediums, because it seems, I suppose, that we're not the only people who like Stephen King. Like, can you believe that? Like, the whole world's
he's
a hipster
now. He's
the most
successful popular author of the last 30, 40 years. So, yeah, he's had a profound effect on, like, into our entire generation. Like, everyone in Gen X and millennials basically grew up reading him all over the world, and that influence has been broad and pervasive.
Which is crazy, because he's a genre author, but he has had mainstream success. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, he's a much better writer than you normally associate with quote-unquote genre.
And during our lifetimes, I think we've seen genre go from being outside the mainstream to being the mainstream. And
absolutely.
I think that you can kind of watch his influence along with these days Marvel movies being the most important thing or whatever. But it's interesting, did all of us come to Stephen King when we were in elementary school, like before we were ostensibly supposed to? Is that
fifth grade for sure.
Yeah,
same here, fifth grade. And it's funny, my genesis of Stephen King was we went in my fifth grade, you know, public school, once a month we'd go to the big library, like the town library.
And
the cool kids in my class, Scott and Monica, when everyone else went to the little kids section to get kids books, they ran into the adult stacks to check out Stephen King books, and I watched them and like followed behind them and picked a Stephen King book and took it home, thinking I'd be cool too. But I've checked out the Dead Zone, and I remember desperately trying to read it, and like I just really couldn't make heads or tails of it, and I felt so like uncool and not sophisticated. And I like begged my dad to get back to the library because I wanted to get a different book. But I went back to the Stephen King books and I looked through all of them and I found Cycle of the Werewolf, which had pictures.
Yes, it sure did.
And it was shorter and I loved it. And that was my first entry into the world of Stephen King.
That's a good introductory Stephen King book, even though you're right, because it has gorgeous illustrations. Yeah, it's still as violent as hell. It's still King, but it's...
Right. Well, and then the next one I read was Salem's Lot, which is much more, you know, hardcore than that, but I loved it too. So then I was totally hooked, so...
I gotta tell you, the first Stephen King book I read was The Uncut Stand.
Wow!
That's going in both feet at the
same
time.
Isn't it like 1,000 pages?
1,137 pages, I know, because I looked at it.
Wow. I mean, there are a few illustrations, but that's not a very good beginner, Stephen King. That's amazing.
That was definitely jumping into the icy water, feet first, head first.
God, that's not just terrifying. That's a terrifying book for a number of reasons. Like,
Oh yeah. It was absolutely not the, I mean, I turned out okay-ish, but you know, like definitely like there was a lot of stuff in that book, especially the uncut one where you're just like, wow, is this the way the world is, Stephen King? And it's the way Stephen King's world is. But
yeah, you know. I think The Stand was like the fifth or sixth one I read, and I read the cut one because the uncut one wasn't out yet.
Yeah. When I read it. Yeah.
What was your first book, Nadia?
No, actually, my first book by King in grade six was Eyes of the Dragon.
Oh, that is ideal. In fact,
that was ideal.
Over Thanksgiving, I was talking about a fairy tale with my cousin, and her son wants to get into Stephen King, and she was asking what he should start with, and I suggested Eyes of the Dragon.
Eyes of the Dragon, for sure.
He's like seven. So I was like,
a little young.
There's nothing that bad in Eyes of the Dragon. It's more about, in fact, Eyes of the Dragon is more about just learning that your father is disappointing. That's a
good Eyes of the Dragon. You could also learn about erectile dysfunction, depending on how old you are. I remember the King having a real big problem with that. Yeah. But I started with, my mom was a huge, huge, huge King fan. She had all the hardcovers.
That's amazing.
When they first came out. She had that original version of Eyes of the Dragon that had that really nice, those paintings and whatnot. So that was kind of what attracted me to the book. And I went ahead and read it. And that's kind of started my awakening. But she also had the original version of The Stand, which was her favorite book. And she got the hardcover, which had that really boss ass picture of the rat flag fighting the hero, like kind of the whole like God devil metaphor going on. It's a really cool illustration.
I was actually going to talk about that a little bit later, like the cover of The Stand, the hardcover of The Stand, because like that is my earliest Stephen King memory, is seeing that artwork and just being like, what is this book? Like, it's just called The Stand, and it has these two people on it, or creatures, or whatever they are, just going at it, good and evil. And for me at least, like as a kid looking at that, I'm like, this book must contain the answers to the universe. Like,
no, you're absolutely right, because I kind of had the same impression. I guess all three of us, kind of being writers and kind of therefore effed up in the head, were certainly influenced by those illustrations and by those like first early. I guess like our first entry into adult fiction, as it were. Stephen King, you can lob a lot of criticism at him for sure, but his writing is very accessible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something I actually try to strive for in my writing as well. But
And I think it's worth pointing out, about like the hardcovers there. Like, I think it's worth pointing out in this age of like digital books or something, that in the 80s, in the 80s, like, a shelf full of Stephen King hardcovers, whether it's at your parents' library or the big library downtown or whatever, but like that's an impressive bookshelf. Like,
yeah,
you know, he's the most popular author of the last generation, as Shane pointed out, and he could afford good bindings, good cover artwork, good logos. I mean, God, like Stranger Things is just ripping off the style of King's books.
And really his first five, six novels were such huge successes that the publishers knew that they could market him and spend the money to give him, you know, great graphic design and huge promotion, and like it was a big deal. He was instantly a huge deal. So us as kids growing up in the 80s, like, yeah, he was just like an event already, in a way that like other authors were not marketed in that way.
He was a name. King, four letters right there on the side of the book. The books themselves are hundreds of pages,
big
hardcovers, but they look not like literature per se, but they look like events.
I mean, and think about
the way that, like, a Marvel movie is an event.
Think about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, which is pretty important to me. It's a film that my father showed me when I was like 9 years old, and it totally messed me up, and I love it. And, you know, Stanley Kubrick was a very well-respected director who chose to do that because The Shining is a great book, and Stephen, you know, it was a huge deal, right? Like, you know, think about that. Like, one of the greatest directors, like, chose to do that back then, and it was, you know, as good as it is. So, yeah, like, I think the profound cultural impact of Stephen King, like, we, you know, it wasn't an anomaly that all of us kind of found him and, like, gravitated towards him. And like, you know, I kind of had a renaissance a few years ago where I came back to King after, like, my, you know, I stayed with him through the Dark Tower ending, and then I like, kind of waned a bit. And, like, in the last few years during quarantine and stuff, I kind of came back to him and have been rediscovering it. And, if you're a lapsed King fan, I recommend going back and like, reading some of the old ones and catching up on things you've missed. There's so much. And he's so prolific.
I don't know if you've read any of his new stuff, Shane, but, like, he himself has kind of turned a leaf. And I think since around 2018 or so, he's been turning out that his late 90s, early 2000 work was, except for the Dark Tower, I think, like, was kind of not his best, but like the outsider, if you haven't read that, like, I think that's one of his best ones. Like, it's really good.
Well, and a lot of the things that were endemic to the 70s and 80s, you know, sexism, some racism, some things, things that were just more of the time, he's really turned that around. And that's not as present or not present at all in a lot of his more modern stuff, which is great as well.
So, oh, yeah, that's pretty good. As much as I love his classic work, it does have some problems with that. Okay. And especially with the quote unquote magical Negro trope. He's really, really bad about that. Yeah. Really bad.
For me, it's just kind of like, how much cocaine was Stephen King on when he was writing this book?
Oh, but like I'm a Tommyknocker supporter. I'm a Tommy head, and like that's probably his most coked out book. But I like it.
I thought they're readapting it to a movie next year.
Yeah, it got off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And why hasn't there been? I mean, maybe you're going to argue that Earthbound is the Tommyknockers. I don't know, but like there needs to be more Tommyknockers influence in games.
I never even thought about Earthbound. Like, we'll get to Earthbound for sure. But like,
I don't think Earthbound.
Maniac Mansion and the Meteor, is that a Tommyknocker?
Maybe could be.
Oh yeah. Hey, you got something there. You got something going there.
But yeah, game developers, rip off the Tommyknockers. It's a good idea.
Yeah, that is actually good. Rip off Eyes of the Dragon. Hell, rip it all off. I don't care. So going briefly over Stephen King, like we already obviously just kind of blew everything about him over here. But just a quick rundown. He's a scene horror author, obviously born in 1947. Apparently he's written, I don't know if this is like an up-to-date number. Maybe it wasn't, but I think it might be like 64 books. I feel like Nintendo 64 books. I feel like he would have done more by now. But then again, he's also written like 200 short stories or something like that. So
right, of those 64 books, like 10 are short story collections, I think. So
yeah. Which is like I mean, good for the guy. I start feeling lightheaded if I have to type 600 words, so he goes. Like, I respect his work ethic. I remember hearing a story once about how George R. Martin asked him, like, you know, oh man, don't you hate writer's block? And Stephen King's like, no, I don't really get it. So
I mean, his book on writing was really influential too, I think, when it came out in like the early 2000s.
I have not read it yet, but I've heard it's great. I've heard nothing but good things about it.
No, it's really good. I mean, a lot of it is kind of seems obvious in that self-helpy book sort of way. But, you know, what Stephen King, but what he really drives, I mean, he has a lot of good advice about writing and structure and the English language and stuff. But what he also talks about a lot is just his work ethic and right. Like, you know, like, writing is a job, and if you're not doing your job, you're not a writer.
So I think you can all relate to that.
I also enjoy his nonfiction book about the history of horror called Danse Macabre. It's pretty good. Yeah.
Oh, really? I just actually heard that mentioned when I was reading up on him. But yeah
and it was first written back in the 80s, and it was revised later. And I read it for the first time 2 years ago, and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, cool. Speaking of revised books, going back to Stand for half a second there, I just from thinking about how they tried to revise that one for the 90s, and some of the things they put in there was just hilariously wrong, but anyway, yeah, at least they tried. Apparently Stephen King had a newsletter in his university newspaper called Stephen King's Garbage Truck, and that's just just the best name I've ever heard of for like a blog or a newspaper or a news column or anything.
Actually, there's a really great Stephen King podcast that I'm a huge fan of called The Losers Club. And just in the last year, they covered his writings for The Garbage Truck and read a bunch of them. And it is some crazy fun stuff. And it gives you a lot of insight into where Stephen King is coming from to read his college writings.
Yeah. I'm sure. Like, I could just imagine just with us, like, I haven't done much of that. But
a little plug for The Losers Club.
While you're talking about podcasts, Shane, have you listened to Just King Things at all?
No, I've heard it's good, actually.
Yeah. I haven't heard of that one you're talking about, so we'll have to do a podcast swap.
Dude, podcast swap. Speaking of things that messed up Stephen King, yeah, apparently he saw a friend get hit by a train when he was a boy, which shocked him to his core, apparently, but he doesn't remember that. So some people are saying, oh, well, maybe it's subconscious, but he says no, probably what got him into horror was finding a collection of Lovecraft's works, which, yeah, that stands to reason.
There's a lot of that in King, but also part of his narrative that is a little interesting is that his dad just left. Like you said, he was going out for cigarettes and never came back.
Oh, so that's the joke my dad's always making.
Yeah. I mean, that really happened to Stephen King.
Not a joke to him.
No, for sure. I mean, I'm sure he'd laugh if he heard me say this, but whenever like Kat has to, whenever my host Kat can't do Blood God 1 week, we always say, oh, Kat went out for cigarettes. I'm sure she's coming back. And we, so my dad used to say that to me. He used to say, you know, someday I could say I'm going out for cigarettes, never come back. You know that, right? And he wasn't doing it to be mean. He just liked to tease me like that. So if you ever want to know why I'm effed in the head, that's probably part of the reason right there.
Had it really happened, you might have been the best-selling author of the last 40 years.
There you go. Thanks, Dad. Thanks so much.
You came back.
You came back, you idiot. So why don't we start a little bit by talking about just listing out a few of his most influential stories. Like, we've already gone over some that you have. And these stories will be brought up during the podcast.
I mean, Carrie's his first novel, and it's hugely influential. The film is fantastic. Before Carrie came out, people didn't really know what telekinesis was. And think about how influential, not really, the mainstream average Americans had no idea what telekinesis was until Carrie. Carrie kind of popularized telekinesis.
I have to admit, like, I have read Carrie, but that's not the one I know, one of my best known novels by him. So just why did he decide to go latch on to telekinesis, though? Does he have any explanation for that?
I have heard some quotes about it, but yeah, I think it's unique and interesting in how it's presented. And the fact that his first novel is from a female perspective, and the novel itself isn't told in a traditional style. It's, how do you say that? Epistolary? Is that how you say that, Andrew? Like, where letters. It's like letters and fragments and, and I think that the novel was an instant success, and then the De Palma film is what I think a classic. And like that imagery from the De Palma film, you see.
Yes. You know,
In other games, in other media. So I think Carrie, as his first published novel, and being his debut, is a huge part of his legacy.
No, for sure.
What about Pet Sematary? Would you consider that one of his more influential works?
Sure. I mean, but I think, you know, we get to The Shining before that. I think it goes like, yeah, Carrie, The Shining, The Stand, Pet Sematary. Okay. I think those are his first four that I think are his most important.
The Shining, it's just like a loop where the book influenced the movie, influenced the games, influenced the books. Like, but you know, it all started with his book there. And like, I know we're going to talk about it, but like
I can't really skip Salem's Lot, which is 77. Yeah, Salem's Lot's in there too.
Oh, of course, right.
Again, these first five novels, and you know, The Dead Zone's also in this area too. But and Salem's Lot is his second novel. It's before The Shining.
See, I am definitely a little bit, like, I wrote down some of the titles here, but I am definitely fuzzy on the chronology of the publication. So it is kind of interesting to go back and see how he progressed from story to story and what he kind of latched onto theme-wise. Right.
And, you know, Salem's Lot is not, it's a twist on Dracula. It's not completely original. I think, you know, it seems almost a little bit, like, obvious in hindsight. But then again, Dracula wasn't, you know,
vampires weren't mainstream.
Right. And in 1977, true. Like, you know, Dracula wasn't as just like pervasive almost too. It's, you know, it's a long time.
And I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead, but I think even with Salem's Lot, he's bringing his own unique twist to the story, which is, yes, it's about the vampires, but it's also about small towns. It's also,
Well, and it's also the beginning of having an author as the, you know, protagonist, right. Which is in probably half of his novels. And it's often,
you know,
right, and it's often just kind of a thinly veiled version of him. But I think there's going to be a new film of Salem's Lot in 2023, so that's kind of going to be relevant again. So yeah.
I guess it would be after it. Yeah, have another hit on your hands.
It's been really interesting to see. I don't know if you, I don't want to talk about Not King, but like, there's been a lot of good horror movies in 2022, and it seems like there's a lot of good ones coming up too. And like, I think a lot of his work is like the Tommyknockers, for God's sake. Salem's Lot, and so on. Like, there's new adaptations, readaptations. I think people are hungry for horror in a way that they weren't necessarily like 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that he is probably going to have another moment in the cultural consciousness again with all these new adaptations coming.
They need to remake The Langoliers. You're going to talk about remakes. I love that stupid movie.
I also love that terrible made-for-TV movie with Bronson Pinchot and like the worst CGI of all time.
It's pretty bad. It looked like tribbles, like coming down from heaven. It was pretty awful.
I'm a fan of that novella, and I think it would make a good video game.
I do like the novella.
It would make a good like point and click adventure game or something to me.
It would actually. And speaking of point and click adventures, I did not know this, but there are several games based on Stephen King's.
Works. Yeah. Well, I don't know if that was like a side hatch. We'll crawl down later, and we could talk about those. But I think we're going back to the formative King works. Before we even get to 1980, it's important to think about The Dark Tower of the Gunslinger, which also started in like 1977. And like for most people,
right there at the beginning.
Right. And most readers didn't become aware of it until 1988, because it was only a really limited hardback until it got published as a trade paperback right before The Drawing of the Three came out in 88.
Was that when they introduced the revisions to it? Because remember...
No, the revisions came out before Wizarding Glass is when the revised version came out. But like, I remember as I was aware, in 1988, I was already a Stephen King fan. And I remember going to the bookstore and suddenly here was not just like The Dark Tower of the Gunslinger, but the second one. And I was like, what are these? And like, I never heard of them, you know, because there's no internet or anything back then. And like, yeah, so The Dark Tower is a through line, and it ends up being this meta concordance that connects all of Kingdom into one ginormous tale.
We'll get into it.
But the fact that he, you know, during his formative years when he's releasing all these bangers, you know, in his beginning of his career, he starts this thing that's very different. That's a Western fantasy that is, you know, very oblique compared to his other novels. So early on, he's giving a lot to his readers.
And it's always been very personal, the gunslinger, The Dark Tower. That's always been King's, like you said, his through line. And, you know, I think it is really interesting that even when the Dark Tower, even though it's a lot of the King's fans' favorite work or one of their favorite works, like the Dark Tower has always felt like the one that King does for himself. You know, like he does the other ones to pay the bills, to get the movies, to be the internationally successful writing superstar. But the Dark Tower is the one where he's like, this is my mythology. Mm-hmm. This is my stamp that I want to leave on the world. Do we even want to talk about the Stephen King games? They're so bad.
I'm looking over my notes, thinking,
my favorite thing would be the whole Roberta and Ken Williams Sierra thing, where like they really wanted to work with Stephen King in the 80s. I could go find the exact quote, but there's an interview from Roberta Williams from where she talks about how she kept reaching out to Stephen King because she wanted him to write a horror game and that they would work on this. And eventually he did get in touch and he's like, I don't know who you are. I don't like games. I don't want to work on this with you. So then she ended up doing Phantasmagoria by herself. And then that set me on a quest to like, and I found this piece that Stephen King wrote for Entertainment Weekly back when he did a column. He did a whole giant column about video games.
I saw that. Yep.
Yeah. And it's interesting because he's defending the fact that they shouldn't be, you know, Congress was, you know, saying video games are violent. He was defending them, but at the same time, he's like, he kind of says he hates video games. He's terrible at them.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's a quote here. It's like, I won't argue for the artistic value of stuff like God of War or 50 Cent Bulletproof. actual quote from Stephen King.
Don't feel too bad, Shane, because, you know, John Carpenter is out there getting high and playing video games.
Yeah, he loves video games. Like,
oh, shit, really?
He's a super gamer.
John Carpenter is a mega gamer.
Yeah. But Stephen King, no fan of games, didn't want to work with Roberta, doesn't care for God of War, 50 Cent. But we have had a few direct Stephen King inspired video games, including The Lawnmower Man for Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo. Yes. It is bad. I rented it. It is not good at all.
Did you actually rent it thinking you were going to get something similar to the book or the story?
It's based on the film, which
the film,
I love.
Right.
Which I love.
Oh, I never seen it. It looks so terrible.
Oh, you had to be there. Oh, Andrew, you saw it in the theater, right?
Oh, of course.
At the time, it had like literally the best computer graphics.
Mind blowing.
Really?
The mind's eye.
Spectacular.
It looked like violent Tron.
I think what you're talking about, King himself not playing games, though, is really one of the more fundamental contradictions about King's influence on games, which is he has had so much indirect influence on creators, on our culture, on the whole, even the idea of horror and horror villains and so on and so forth. But when you start looking, okay, but where has he had a direct influence? It's like, it's not there. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about how Stephen King has influenced games. We're actually in many ways, you know, talking about how Stephen King influenced culture.
That's true. Yeah.
Horror as a whole. And we'll get to it. There are some specific games where the connection is much more than tenuous, but it's not like It's not like you can draw a through line. We're like, oh yeah, Stephen King co-wrote this, you know, 7-game horror series, yeah, which was super popular in the 80s and 90s. He never had that kind of connection or influence to it. It's always been more like, just by virtue of being the biggest horror author in the entire world, that horror and genre culture can't get out from under his shadow.
Well, and the closest there is the PC adventure game out based on The Dark Half, which is a novel I actually really enjoy.
Yeah, it actually looked pretty good.
And the fact that that game exists is interesting because it is completely original. It's kind of stuck on PC. It has pretty good visuals for the time. And I remember I worked at a game store when that came out, and it was kind of weird at the time. I was like, this is weird. Like, how did this happen? And there are ways to play it. And I've heard it's a bit of a slog. I watched a little bit of it, but it's interesting that that occurred, that he allowed that to happen.
I actually tried to play it a few months ago. I was going on a big DOS PC adventure game kick where I was like, not Sierra, not LucasArts. Like, I'm going to play all the weird stuff. And it had some really, it was trying really hard. Like, it's much more than you would expect from a licensed adventure game, but it's still fairly unplayable, unfortunately. but it was interesting though, just because it's like, oh, these people really went for it with the technology that they had at the time.
Yeah.
In terms of the graphics, the interface, the way the story is told.
It's interesting that at no point was Stephen King like lured at, you know, to just like work on a game. It's true. Remember like Clive Barker's Undying? That was a game. Anyway.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It was good.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking about that, how like Stephen King, like he's never really accepted a few dollars to write something. Well, like you said, he said, I don't like games. And he just.
And super early internet, he did have like an internet only like continuing work called The Plant that he never finished. He like started The Plant and then he just like quit after like two chapters.
He never finished that.
Never finished it.
There was uproar over it.
Yeah, and I think fans sometimes still ask him, "Hey, when's like Plant Part 4 coming out?"
Finishing.
Oh, now that he finished The Dark Tower, we have to harass him about something.
There you go. There's also a text adventure based on The Mist. No graphics at all, just text.
Really?
Kind of reminds me how I went through it. Yeah.
Like official, like a real official product, not just like a fan thing?
I'm pretty sure it was official. I'm trying to remember who, by Mindscape, yeah, 1985. Wow. It was
early too. Yeah.
Yeah. It actually resembles when I was a kid, I used to play, actually the way I got into Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is I played a Commodore 64 game based on the books. And it was the exact same thing where you had the books text.
That I've played. It's good.
Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. And that's kind of what they had going on for The Mist.
I'm sorry. I'm a huge Hitchhiker's fan, so I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. Like, Douglas Adams loved computers. Douglas Adams wrote most of the text in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, along with Stephen Retzke.
I didn't know that.
Learned how to do the Z machine coding for Infocom so that he could understand how the puzzles are created. And that's why that game is full of weird parser tricks. And like, you have to take the no T. And then you have no T as an object.
Yeah.
and you'll have things like doors that argue with you, and like you have to try to go through the door like 5 or 6 times before it finally relents and starts describing what's on the other side of the door to you. Before that, it's just like there's nothing here. Go stay where you are. but I think that's just really an interesting comparison that like Douglas Adams even wrote a non-Hitchhiker's game for Infocom, Bureaucracy. Which is also hilarious. And so, you know, there were other genre authors who were, you know, they got that bee up their butt about like, oh, games are cool. Are games the future? I don't know, but I want to try. I want to figure out what's going on here. And like, King's a no on that.
Yeah. But I do appreciate the fact, even though he's like, I'm suck at games. I don't like them at all. He did stand up for them, like Shane pointed out. So he wasn't like one of those, oh, I hate games because they ruin children these days. I mean, I'm a huge, huge Redwall fan. And Brian Jakes actually wrote something for the Toronto Star way back in the day when the Redwall cartoon first came out, because it was by Nelvana. Basically wrote a thing saying how kids, if you these days, since they type, they don't know how to write for real. And it's like, you know what? Nah, I'm not into that kind of attitude. So if you don't like video games, that's fine. But you say, hey, there's someone else's thing. That's also totally fine. Just don't go around saying, oh, I'm an old man, kids these days, blah, blah, blah. That stuff just drives me up the wall.
Well, I mean, even though he has such mainstream success, King's works have always been kind of violent and gory and extreme in content and in some ways. And he himself has had his share of controversy about should these books be carried in libraries? You know, is it okay for kids in the fifth grade, like me and Shane? Right.
Well, and even, you know, Stephen King post school shootings did withdraw Rage, you know, that no longer is available.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, he's no stranger to First Amendment controversies. And I think that's probably a large part of why, even if he doesn't like games, he understands, mm-hmm. you know, that's the first domino. And if you don't stand up there, that people are going to, you know, it was comics for a while. You know, it's whatever is considered the lowbrow media of the time is always kind of the first to be put in the crosshairs of politicians when they're trying to put up those guardrails that don't need to be there. And so, you know, he has enough self-awareness, I think, to realize that, you know, he has to stand up for the people on the gaming side of the fence, or he and his writing is going to be next.
Yeah, for sure. So like you said, he knows what it's like to be on that side. So going to like just basically games that had that inspiration, that kind of that King vibe, as it were, we have a few to go through. And I think maybe we should start with one that you pointed out, Andrew, kind of deserves really its own sidebar, is Alan Wake. Alan Wake. Let's start there.
So, yeah. So first of all, I just want to say Remedy as a game developer are great. Mm-hmm. And they are the only people, whether directly or indirectly, I think, who have ever tuned into King's wavelength and that have made games that feel like King's novels, you know,
right.
Cause King, I mean, and again, we're going to talk about, we are talking about this now, but you know, like King's books are very often vibes. Like King's books are very often like tone and mood and writing in terms of phrase and really evocative language that really makes you see something or feel something in a real strong and powerful way. And, you know, like look at the dialogue in a Max Payne game, even though that's not a King game. Like I would say that the writing in Max Payne is very much like the writing in a King book in terms mm-hmm. of trying to evoke that strong reaction in a reader where it doesn't sound like people talk, but it sounds awesome anyways. And
yeah.
So, but, you know, with Alan Wake for sure. And I think with Control, so the Control 2, like they tapped into those vibes. So the thing that interests me about King and horror is that games need structure.
Yeah.
And games need to tell the player what to do and where to go and to provide them with a framework for how they experience the game. And King's works are often the opposite of that.
Right.
King's works are often really almost like abstract and cosmic and ill-defined about the specific details. They're much more a mood than kind of like, you know, oh, the Evil Institute is making bio zombies and we have to go, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're, it's not that. It's just kind of like, what if there's something out there and you don't know what it is?
That's
and
a big like, thing in King, for sure.
And it's like, and that's scary, but if you're making a game, you're like, okay, but I want to know what it is. I want to go find it. I want to shoot it. I want to pick up what it drops. And I want to move on to the next thing. And so I think there's a real tension between, you know, King's writing and King's tone and the structure of what people expect from a video game. That said, Remedy has leaned into that with Alan Wake and with Control as well. In terms of Control is full of like weird unexplained things that just kind of show up, like what's the oldest house, why is it called the oldest house, like I don't know, that it sounds ominous, and like roll with it and move forward with it, and that's not what this game is about, but it's there and it's going to set the tone. And for Alan Wake in particular, Shane, have you played the Alan Wake games?
I've not played it, but I've heard that it has direct references to Stephen King.
100%. I mean,
they actually they gave him a copy, as I understand it, and he was like, "Well, thanks, but again, I don't play games."
So, like there's the Alan Wake games, like, you know, the main character is an author. He's a horror author, and you know, like he's it's metafictional too, in so much as like he is becoming, it's like the Dark Half or something. He's becoming trapped inside the world that he's writing. And there's actually something called the Dark Presence in Alan Wake, which is kind of out there and entrapping him. And there's so many direct references to King's works, both tonally and structurally in Alan Wake. And there was a follow-up too called Alan Wake's American Nightmare, which was like a quasi-expansion, which is not as good a game as Alan Wake, and it doesn't have the same sense of horror, but it has a sense of being like, it's like it's narrated like one of Stephen King's books. Like it's right. it's even more metafictional, you know, that it's like if Alan Wake is like a Stephen King story, then American Nightmare is like being trapped inside the process of making a Stephen King story.
Oh shit, how do I get out?
Or something.
It's like when Stephen King shows up in book 6 of Dark Tower.
Absolutely.
Hi, kids, I'm Stephen King.
spoiler alert.
We have a lot of fun here, but you know, it's not fun.
So I think the reason that it works so well is because mood and plot, they're not the same thing.
Right.
And the Remedy games, what they borrow from King and what they take from King is the mood. And so it's okay if the plot is something different, like in the case of Control, where it's kind of science fiction-y, kind of SCP-style objects, or in the case of Max Payne, where it's kind of like a noir. Like they still both have that. Like, I mean, Stephen King himself worked in genres other than horror as well. You know,
and a lot of his output the last two decades has been crime.
Yeah. So you know, I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say that like the Max Payne stuff is kind of overlapping with the stuff that he's working on. But I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm dismissing the plot references. Like Alan Wake is Stephen King, like straight up. Like,
but are there like direct kind of nods to like The Shining and stuff in it? Like, you know, specific.
I always
King
thought that
King
like,
works.
See, I haven't played Alan Wake, but I do know about what is that song, The Poet and the Muse, and I know that's a song within the game that is used as kind of a clue giver. And to me, the final verse of The Poet and the Muse always reminded me a lot. I know it's not a direct reference, but it might be kind of what you're talking about, Shane, is it reminded me a lot of the ending of Pet Sematary, the events that is described in that. It's just the way it's described is that a woman came back from the dead and her husband or her boyfriend or her lover killed her because he knew what he had done. He'd done something terrible. And the very, very end of Pet Sematary is freaky as hell.
Oh, it's
terrifying.
I think Pet Sematary is Stephen King's scariest book.
It absolutely is.
And it's scarier as an adult. I reread it like 2 years ago and it blew my mind how good it is. Yeah.
And just that, like, we don't know that Lewis killed Rachel Zombie, whatever you want to call her, but you certainly get that implication in your head from past events that you know in the story have happened, where someone came back and they were not at all what they once were, so their loved ones killed them. So you kind of, I don't know, that's to me, I always made that connection. I don't know if it's intentional, but given as Alan Wake, it probably was.
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's definite direct references to, I mean, it's like, The setting is basically Derry. Like it's just the town in Maine that King's always working in. And again, it is a lot like the Dark Tower because it's about how Alan Wake gets trapped inside his own creation and has to try to write his way out, basically.
In the dead of night she came to him with darkness in her eyes. We're in a morning gown, sweet words as her disguise. Took her in without a word, for he saw his great mistake, and vowed them both to silence deep beneath the lake. Now if it's real or just a dream, one mystery remains, for it is set on moonless nights, they may still haunt this place.
And actually, this is really tangential, but it's something that I think is interesting, is Alan Wake was not re-released for a long time because of music rights issues, because a song from Poe's Haunted plays over the end credits.
Oh, fantastic album.
It is a fantastic album. And as you probably know, Poe is the sister of Mark Danielewski, who wrote House of Leaves and the book.
It's basically the House of Leaves album.
The album is a companion album to House of Leaves. And so I think that again, you know, even though that's House of Leaves, that's not Stephen King, I think House of King plays into that. And the House of King is way more about the mood and the tone and the interactions between these people as they explore that than like, all right, here's the logical rules about how the house works. Let me explain like where the house came from and what it's doing. And like none of that arises or comes up. And so like as a developer, they're just very much on this wavelength of I'm going to talk about this a little bit. Like the other kind of elephant in the room about horror games, I would say, is probably like Lovecraft. Eternal Darkness and Alone in the Dark. And there's just all sorts of
so many games.
And so like Lovecraft is about like unknowable cosmic horrors. And like, if I had to describe what King is about, it's about knowable cosmic horrors. It's about, you know, he definitely goes for the cosmic. He definitely goes for like the big bads, but he always finds a way to humanize them or connect them to the relationships of the people.
Have you finished Fairy Tale, where the big bad is literally just like a giant Lovecraftian, you know, monstrosity with tentacles at the end? No. I mean, he kind of knows it, because that Fairy Tale is kind of about stories, and he's like very self-referential. But he's still different from that. Well, from Tentacle Beasts.
It's actually interesting that you guys brought that up, because a long, long time ago, I think I actually linked to it in the notes, I wrote a story for 1UP about Stephen King's influence on video games.
Number one search engine optimization if you search Stephen King video games.
Oh, where was that search engine optimization when US Gamer was?
I went to click on it. It was like, this is gonna be full of info that Nadia has never heard. Oh wait,
Jesus. Nadia wrote it. Psych.
I'm just amazed 1UP.com is still available for people to read. So
I'm extremely impressed. I had no idea what was going on, but I'm happy that it's still there. But when I wrote that article, it might not even been that article. I think it might have even been a Retronauts, really old Retronauts blog post I did for in the day.
Is Retronauts so old that we're doing Retronauts about previous Retronauts episodes?
Retronauts has moved around, my friends. But it was basically about the relationship between, I said that It and Earthbound had a whole lot in common. And someone, of course, said to me, oh, excuse me, actually, Earthbound didn't invent Lovecraftian stuff, or Stephen King didn't invent Lovecraftian stuff. And I said, yes, but the point is Lovecraft, Earthbound, which we'll get into in much more depth soon, and It are both about the same thing, which is about childhood conquering terrible things from across the stars, like wishes and, you know, prayers and magic and stuff like that. That's not Lovecraft's department. That's more Stephen King's department, and it's actually, I guess, Earthbound's department as well.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen King likes people, even if he puts them through.
Yeah.
I think he fundamentally believes that, like, people can stand up to evil, and people can should stand up to evil, and that it's the responsibility of people to stand up to evil.
Yeah, I think his ability to write interpersonal friendships and relationships and have, like, strong groups of characters working together is one of his strongest suits, and it's why lot of people keep coming back to his works. And I think it's what's so great about things like It and The Body, you know. But and like, it's interesting with it, we'll get into its influence, but like, I'm actually kind of surprised that there hasn't been more just like direct influence of It on video games. Like, as much as there's been, you'd think there'd be even more.
Well, the thing, I mean, I've been thinking about this, and I'm like, maybe it influences like Japanese RPGs and their structure in terms of just kind of like the first act, the second act, the increasing escalation of cosmic threats.
I'm surprised we never got like a 16 or 32 bit JRPG that was literally like kids growing up fighting monsters, having to come back 20 years later, and a killer clown. Like, that never happened. Exactly.
Not even right?
It kind of could have. Clown. Yeah.
So you describe that, and I'm like, no, it must have happened. You're just forgetting it. It was what was it called? And I guess it didn't happen, but it sounds like it should have.
It was Rhapsody, a musical adventure. No, I wish.
It was Rhapsody, a musical, if only.
I'm like, maybe if you like play Persona 1 and Persona 2 at the same time, you can like kind of get an it.
Oh, yeah. You can kind of fake it, but I honestly think Earthbound is our closest bet here.
I think you're right. I mean, I think and Earthbound, it's funny because Earthbound has that same 50s nostalgia that Stephen King has. Like so much of Stephen King, the uber boomer, is like ultimate 50s nostalgia. Like, you know, if I had a dime for every evil greaser bully in his books, right? Like he clearly got beaten up by greasers in high school. Like, yeah. And Earthbound does kind of capture that 50s love, I think.
I think also what really did it for me when things finally clicked for me was the final battle of Earthbound, shock spoilers, where they are trapped in what's essentially the Deadlights. Like you cannot, the words that made it click to me was you cannot comprehend Gigas' true form, which was pretty much the spider dimensional being it from the book, the way I read it.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what kind of made me say, hey, wait a minute. This is just it. Where have I been? Why have I been asleep this whole time? So I was pretty impressed by that. I think that's when I wrote the article because I played Earthbound much later than most people, around 2008 or so. And I had just read the book as well. So I, smart me, made this article that someone immediately said, oh, no, it's not. So internet writing.
I think if we're kind of comparing it to Earthbound a little bit too, I think one of the strengths of Stephen King is his ability to describe the mundane as like a layer on top of or obscuring the horror that lies underneath. Like, you know, the horror is not always on the surface. And in fact, it usually isn't. Did you read, was it 11/22/63 or whatever? The one about the Kennedy assassination?
No, I've kind of been saving it and I have it. And like, I think it might be my next one. I've heard some people think it's his best.
I think it's good. I think it's really good. But that one definitely, I mean, gosh, you want your boomer nostalgia. What more JFK blown away?
What if I could stop JFK from being assassinated by traveling through time?
Exactly. Every boomer's dream.
Every boomer's dream.
No, but you know, that book in particular too, like it almost is a historical novel. And just what really struck me about that book was like, it's like 100 pages just about like Lee Harvey Oswald's like home life, like not about like, oh, what a crazy killer he is, but just about like, here's the kind of house he lives in. Here's the kind of car he drives. Here's the kind of job he has. Here's his relationship with his wife and his neighbors and stuff. And like, he just, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald, it's the guy who shot Kennedy. Like we're not supposed to sympathize with him or empathize with him. And I don't think we do, but he still humanizes him.
Right.
He still takes the time to make him an actual character and a bad character who does bad things like killing the president of the United States of America. but he's King doesn't take the easy way out and just be like, oh, this is the evil guy who's just baddie, bad, bad, bad. And like, you know, like, I mean, King writes great villains. He writes horrible people. Like, I don't want to make it sound like these people are sympathetic at all, but they're still characters. They're still humanized.
Oh, even completely. Though they're
awful.
If I think about it, I think about like, you know, Henry or, you know, like someone like Harold in the Stand. Some of these, the worst characters are some of the most interesting ones. He does a great job of making them real and humanizing them and giving you some of their motivations. And yeah,
I mean, The Stand, if you want to get into that for a second, it's just about like not necessarily good versus evil, but the people who are influenced by evil. Mother Abigail herself says something to the effect of, there's not a lot of evil people in this world, but there are a lot of easily influenced people in this world. And sometimes one really feeds into the other.
Yeah. And I mean, if we want to talk about The Stand a little bit, like what makes The Stand so interesting is that it's not about the end of the world. Like was it Captain Trips, the COVID-like disease.
COVID, yay, that was great. That was really great to remember.
Everybody out. Like, I mean, it's a great description of how it all goes down, but like that part of finishes very early in the book.
Yes.
Like that is, it's not drawn out. It's not like what's going to happen, but it just happens. It's over, it's done. And like, it's about the aftermath and it's about the rebuilding and it's about the communities and the people and what they make in this world after everything that they know has gone to
Andrew, I should have known you're one of the Stand fans who loves all the meeting notes. You're like, give me more chapters of meeting notes. Franny's meeting notes.
When I think of The Stand, I think of, you know, people arguing in like a PTA meeting about like how their society should be structured.
I just want to interject because I've had no podcast to complain about CBS All Access The Stand from 2020. Gotcha. What a disappointment.
Oh, what a drop ball. That.
You didn't watch it?
I didn't watch it.
I command you to watch it, especially it's a roller coaster of bad. And like, but Stephen King did write a new ending. There's like a new ending that he wrote. Wow. Like the last, there's like a basically like a new kind of coda epilogue that is interesting, but the rest of it's pretty terrible.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to, you're talking about Earthbound and It. Like, for me, when I look at The Stand, like, all I can see is The Last of Us. Like,
oh, for sure.
The Last of Us to me is just, yeah, there's zombies. Yeah, it's about the end of the world, but it's like 100% about, like, how are people dealing with building a society and with continuing to relate to one another in this world after it's ended.
Yeah, I think you know, The Stand was 1977. I think a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff has been inspired by that. You know, it just has to be. You know, it was very early.
Even Breath of the Wild, to an extent, is kind of the same way. People just kind of gathering, doing what they can at the end of the world.
Or, you know, just like in Stand, like the escape through the tunnel out of New York, which is like that is so tense.
Which is like 200 pages in the end.
I know, right? Like, yeah.
When I go to New York,
the pages went back. It's so long in the end.
Yeah.
When I go to New York now, I can't go through that tunnel without thinking of that. And I'm in New York a lot, so that's good thing to be reminded by. Seasons don't feel the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain.
But, you know, and I think that, you know, for me, Stephen King is, you know, people talk about Stephen King as a horror author, and he is a horror author. But when I think of Stephen King and what I remember from his books, it's the characters.
Yes.
And it's the, I mean, yeah, they creep you out and they scare you and they take you on a roller coaster ride. But what I remember are the people I went on that roller coaster ride with. And I think that's what makes them so much engaging reads, is not just that, oh, this terrible thing is happening and it's so scary. Ooh, it's because you get to know these people who are also being put through this situation. And so you have a really, like, sympathetic emotional response to the horrible things that are happening in the book.
And I feel like that's a broad reaching conversation, but I need to interject here about The Dark Tower. Because so for me, that's my through line. It's the thing that, like, really hooked me early on and was pivotal and kept getting better and better while I was growing up. Like, getting to read Drawing the Three, The Wastelands, Wizard and Glass as they came out. And it's the ultimate RPG in that, you know, it's tight, this party, this quartet, this group of gunslinger adventurers who travel across worlds on this grand adventure to save everything. And huge sacrifices are made. And there's so much King foreshadowing. And it's fantasy, it's sci-fi, it's Western, it's crime. It's everything. And in there was so much expectation built up around this thing that could never fully pay off in a way that was fully rewarding. And he did manage to kind of stick the landing in a way to make it fulfilling and then kind of fix it in post down the way. But I think, you know, as someone who grew up just like loving stories and loving fantasy, to me, it showed this blueprint for an RPG, of sorts, right?
I think it's really important to talk about The Dark Tower for people who haven't read it, which is that, you know, it is a metaverse. It is a Stephen King universe. All of his stories, all of his characters, all of his books, they come back to the Dark Tower, whether directly or indirectly. Well,
and Nadia, just like to say, like in the third book, they end up in The Stand suddenly. And that's like, you know, there've been some subtle things before that to let you know that the worlds cross over, but like suddenly they're in The Stand.
Well, it's like also, I know that Eyes of the Dragon was Dark Tower before there was Dark Tower, because that's linked to the Dark Tower. So is, and this pisses me off, The Talisman, which we'll get into because it's one of my favorite fantasy novels of all time.
The Talisman is fantastic and very gamey.
Extremely gamey, as we will get into, but The Black House, the sequel, was one of the worst things I ever read, and I just can't believe King wrote it. It was that bad.
It ends up being really important to the end of the Dark Tower in a really Deus Ex Machina kind of way. But anyway,
I mean, this is the guy who wrote the whole God's hand coming down and ending The Stand. So
not anymore. Not in the.
Oh, they fix. Oh, so that's what got. Okay.
I'll watch at least the last episode to see what the new ending.
But it's true. Like once you realize that King started weaving everything together here, it just became in itself a game. It gamified being a fan of Stephen King, because you could, like, there were little Easter eggs and nuggets and connections to make everywhere.
He was multiverse before there was multiverse.
For me, at least, like, it's hard to imagine the world before the MCU. It's hard to imagine the world before our cross-media universe. But, like, This is something which weirds me out. Okay. Like I'm going to talk as a parent of a kid for a while. Like the Disney princess brand did not exist until 2006. Okay. So there were,
right. You weren't allowed to put you, they weren't allowed to appear together until Disney decided that they were allowed to be together. Yeah. Right.
And they made the princess theming. And then before that, like Kingdom Hearts is what, 2001, 2002, I think, in the US, like very recent. And like, that's, from my perspective, at least, you know, like when some of these big medias at Disney, Marvel started to break down the walls between their universes and mm-hmm. to be like, well, let's bring these characters together. Let's tell stories where these things cross over. King was doing this like 30 years before.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, and it seems almost trite now to be like, oh, yeah, all of his characters ended up in the same story and they were all crossing over. We're like, nobody else was doing this. And that's I think why, when I say that the Dark Tower was the one he wrote for himself, it's because this is where he could take his favorite toys and he could mm-hmm. put them in his favorite world and he could keep telling new stories with them. No matter what happened to them in their original story, there was a way for them to come back and for their narrative to, and for their tales to continue. He didn't want to say goodbye to these people.
Yeah, and it's true. There's something in there for everybody. Like, if you're a big Salem's Lot fan, you get a huge payoff. If you're an It fan, you get payoff. Like, yeah, there's pretty much something for everybody. If there's King property you love, I think ultimately you should read The Dark Tower.
Yeah,
I think the reason I didn't grow up with it is because my mom was never a fan, and so she didn't really have all the books in her house or on her bookshelf. Well, and I think she might have found it too self-indulgent, ironically.
Nadia, instead of reading Sweet Valley High, you should read Dark Tower.
Why can't we have Sweet Valley High and Dark Tower crossover?
And I think it's, you know, oh my gosh. Okay, so I just thought of this, so I haven't like done any structured thinking about this. But I'm like, the Dark Tower is like Stephen King's actual play podcast of him like taking his favorite characters and putting them through his fantasy world that he's created.
No, absolutely. You're right. So just so before his time. When he described it, that's what I said before Shane brought it up. Like, it's the multiverse. Sorry, before Andrew, you brought it up. It's like, hey, it's the multiverse. Because it is.
Yeah, and it's so rewarding. And it's so, this is the thing which is really fascinating to me. You know, we're talking about, like, King never worked in games, never wrote for a game. Like, he wrote The Dark Tower. Like, The Dark Tower is one of the most beautifully, enjoyably gamey fantasy series I've ever read.
I mean, yeah, the pivotal climax of book three is literally a riddle game, a game of riddles. Like, and there's little puzzles and stuff throughout. Yeah, he's right. It's his most game-like thing, except for maybe The Running Man.
Is there a box moving puzzle in the book?
There may be a crate moving puzzle. Yeah,
pull this lever.
And there's even you know, with Wizard and Glass, it's like Gunslinger Origins. It's like he suddenly stops and like goes back and writes the prequel the way that so many game franchises like to fill out the lore of their stories after they've been around for 10 years or so. They're like, let's go back and see how it all began.
And you never read The Talisman, Andrew?
I have not read The Talisman. Oh, wow. I missed it as a kid. So
it's also a good beginner, or like second or third book, because it was one of the first five I read, and it's much more fantasy, and it's mm-hmm. it's very great. It has some cool characters. Like, Wolf is one of the all-time best characters in any Stephen King book. And it kind of takes place in like, you know, two worlds.
It's like an Easter time, right?
Yeah, and I know, Nadia, you're saying like it kind of has the same plot as Ni No Kuni, and it kind of does.
But it does.
I think that trope of like child having to rescue their mother from a sleeping spell is something that Stephen King and Peter Straub also stole from like European folklore. Or something.
Yeah, but the twinner thing, like, did they steal that?
No, but that, I don't think so. The twin idea is fantastic, actually, that everybody has like, yeah, like a twinner, like alternate person in the other world. Yeah.
I feel like, I'm sorry, but I feel like the fact that she had that Oliver has his mother being, who's a queen in another world, being made sick through, well, you know, like through these linked events. I don't know. To me, it feels like so Talisman.
I think The Talisman would make a great video game.
Oh, actually, it's perfect. It'd be fantastic. Adapt.
Well, apparently you know, Spielberg wanted to make a film of The Talisman for the last like 30 years and never got around to it. But I think someone did option the rights. Maybe it'll happen one day.
Yeah. Well, I know that Shigesato Itoi, speaking about Earthbound and Mother and all that stuff, like, he is a big fan of The Talisman. And yeah, he mentions that he wanted to work actually with the property more, but Senor Spielbergo had the rights. And that was a long, long time ago, and nothing's really happened since then. But yeah, that's a bit of a shame, because it's really a book that deserves more media, like a lot more media. I feel like it was Dark Tower before Dark Tower, and yeah. It's just not really recognized nearly as much as The Dark Tower.
Also, to interject, just the fact that Spielberg put The Shining into Ready Player One is like the meta mix of everything. It's all just very
but they also put Clockwork Orange into Space Jam: A New Legacy. Like,
they sure did.
Along with
I would not
the devil,
read too much into the metaversal.
Yeah, like the nuns from the devils being in Space Jam Legacy is something.
Yeah.
So you said Itoy is a big fan of The Talisman.
Yeah, actually, he mentioned in the interview that I linked to that. The character of Wolf, who Shane and I were just talking about, like, he noticed a similarity between them and the, it's called the Birdman for Magic Ant. Obviously, Wolf came first, but he did notice, like, there's a lot of similarities between Earthbound and The Talisman. And actually, World of Warcraft has a reference to The Talisman. With they have an actual wasted place called the Blasted Lands, which is a nuclear, basically with the Talisman, you have what happens in our world happens in the territories, quote unquote, kind of our parallel universe. Mm-hmm. So during the testing of the atomic bomb, the equivalent in the territories got basically covered in radiation. It's a radioactive wasteland. Nothing can live there except terrifying, horrible mutants. And that's probably the only really scary part of the whole book, actually, is them going through the blasted lands and confronting the mutants living there. So, yeah, it is extremely gamey, as Shane mentioned earlier.
So you mentioned go on.
I was going to say, like, if you like The Talisman, you'll like The Dark Tower. Not
oh, I know it. Yeah. I know it. Absolutely.
The Dark Tower is, like, the quest narrative. And again, it's like the Kotep, it's a party. It is a group of people who are bound together by fate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's, like, towns and worlds and maps and bosses and gods and...
I mean, even the end of The Talisman, you have the MacGuffin, the literal talisman, Hotel, the final boss area.
Well, you've like, yeah, and the Dark Tower is the ultimate MacGuffin. And then the question at the end is, do you actually want to get there? And at the end, you know, before you read the last book, Stephen King's like, I don't want to show this to you, but I know that you want it, so I'm going to give it to you. Yeah, like, he has to deal with like that at the end too, like the ultimate question of like, do I give the reader what they think they want?
To say, I didn't say this on Twitter because everyone would have just said, shut up, Nadia, but when I played Elden Ring and I got to Caelid, the Wasteland, I was like, holy shit, this is the Blasted Lands by Stephen King. Exact same description, the red soil, the horrible yellow disease.
I don't know. Stuff. I kind of like Eric's, when he calls it the Third Impact, I think that's a good description too.
That's pretty perfect. I love how Eric, just like side note for people who don't know, Eric is one of the co-hosts of the Axel Bug God podcast. He's always making the best references, like he's watching... he started a run of Kirby. He's watching it on GameSpunk Quick or something. He's like, oh, this looks like such a fun, marvelous game. And then they get to the end, the final level of Kirby's, the latest game. I can't remember what it's called. Kirby's Forgotten. Sorry. Yeah. Kirby in the Forgotten Land or Kirby in the Forgotten World. So he gets to the end of the last level and says, why is Kirby fighting the 13th angel? Like, I don't love that description.
It really is some cosmic horror. Kirby games go places. So
I'd like to see what King thinks of Kirby games. You'd be like, what the hell is this? Oh, God. Somebody watched Akira.
So you're talking about Itoy. So here's something I've been thinking about a lot, too, is that when we think about Japanese horror, that's kind of in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. But when it first started coming up and in the early 2000s, both movies and games, we started seeing a lot of it. But that stuff was all influenced by King. I mean, the first round stuff and like Silent Hill and Silent Hill 2 in particular.
Oh. Absolutely.
Like, I mean, The Mist. Yeah. like you can't get... Of course, they're doing it for draw distance on the PlayStation or whatever, but just like in terms of like what's out there, what's coming for you, finding safe zones.
I actually kind of have this like personal theory that The Mist became so popular with video games because, dear God, that fog's is a miracle for draw distance cover up. So, hey, everyone, suddenly we have a misty world going on here.
And it's clearly one of the reasons it was done, but it's so effective. Remember at the time when Silent Hill came out, I liked that it wasn't just Resident Evil because Resident Evil is so clearly inspired, you know, by Romero and you know, specifically zombie movies from the 60s and 70s. And Silent Hill was not that at all. It was, yeah, more The Mist or Carpenter's The Fog a little bit too. But you know, the way the horror is presented, the more psychological presentation of it.
And again, that's with Silent Hill 2. Silent Hill 2, you really get into the interpersonal relationship of James and his wife and Maria. And again, we've been kind of dancing around this a little bit, but like there's a weird psychosexual element to Silent Hill 2, which is also present in a lot of
which kind of pops up in King stuff a little bit.
Right. I remember when Silent Hill 2, when it first came out, when it was psychosexual, and you know, I was just shocked. And a little bit of that is references to things like, you know, Hitchcock. But there's definitely Kingian vibes throughout Silent Hill 1, 2, 3, and 4, I think.
I mean, even the street that the opening cafe is on is called Bachman Street.
Right.
And
right,
I think there's
a direct reference to Stephen King's pseudonym Richard Bach.
Yeah, and I can't remember if it's any particular King story, but I feel like The Room feels really, I mean, I guess it's kind of like The Mist from the other side, from the inside or something, but just kind of like the idea of being in this enclosed space with things going on outside of you. You know, that one really strikes me as kind of a Kingian premise.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about The Mist is that it's like, of course, you have this outside world filled with fog and horrible monsters within the fog, but the man is the real monster. But to King's credit, he does it really well in The Mist.
Oh, but I'll never forget my favorite quote in Silent Hill 3 is someone says to Heather, they look like monsters to you. And I was like, that just like blew my mind. That like, oh, like that's what's so great about Silent Hill. Like maybe these aren't even monsters. They're just people.
Even Silent Hill, the first one, the part with the pterodactyl that crashes through the cafe window, that is a direct reference to the pterodactyl monsters in The Mist. And the dear God, The Mist is a terrifying story. It's like Pet Sematary in every respect. There's something there to just freak you out.
The cult stuff in Silent Hill 1 really reminds me of a lot of King's work too. Not necessarily his better work, but definitely I think it's a vibe. Well, again, but we're talking about small towns. Like Silent Hill is a small town, you know, and what Salem's lots of his work, you know, it's about who has the power in the small towns, who is terrorizing people behind, you know, and in King stories, they're supernatural, but that's an actual thing, even in our world, which is that there's these small towns which are just terrorized by small cabals of people that you don't really know what's going on behind.
I mean, I think another really influential short story, Children of the Corn. I mean, obviously the film franchise, the film franchise ran on its own. You know, Urban Harvest is a banger, Part 3. But you know, I think the core idea of like this cult that's like very terrifying and easy to be inspired by.
Yeah, the whole children taking over the town and making a cult out of it. Yeah, that sounds pretty universal at this point. But also just one thing that always stuck out to me about it was the fact that, yes, you had a small town and you had trouble in the small town and people ignored what they saw. You know, oh, no, there's not a child being kidnapped. I'm just going to get up and go in my house. I didn't see that. That's extremely relatable in a really terrifying way. Did any of you remember even Secret World, the MMORPG?
Not yet. I'm friends with the lead writer on the Secret World.
You are not. Oh, it's amazing.
So, yeah, a guy named Ben who used to work at Blizzard when I was there.
I probably got drunk with him that day. It was, I went to go preview the game way, way back in the day. Fun.com, was it? I think.
Who did Funcom.
It? Funcom. That was a fun preview event, actually, because, I remember liking the game. I didn't get to play it when it came out, but there was, like, just the whole thing was one big Stephen King reference. Like, I remember walking down Flag Street, so that I appreciate that very much. But
yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's still, I was actually looking up, it's still available as, like, Secret World Legends, and it's kind of free to play-ish, but I think if you just want to, like, go through the story, and, you know, you don't mind a little bit of free-to-play MMO grindiness, you can probably download it and check it out. Like, it just has, again, that sort of weird, I mean, it, one of it, the towns is like literally Salem's Lot. It's just like a small, it's a small New England town that's been taken over by vampires.
Does it have the house up on the hill like Salem's Lot?
No. I don't remember so. Geographically, but I'll take a look at the map and see. It's possible there's a cemetery, I remember for sure. So anyways, that game, it's urban fantasy, kind of supernatural fantasy, kind of urban legend fantasy, kind of like Gravity Falls mixed with Stephen King. I don't know, but just like there's a lot of really good writing in that game, in my opinion. And a lot, and a lot of that is because, I think this is something that we've been talking about, but I think it's important to emphasize, like, Stephen King is tropey. Like, oh, yeah, Stephen King is like vampires, killer dog,
werewolves.
werewolves, whatever. Like, he's not reinventing the wheel necessarily, but his writing and his characterization and his plotting is what elevates these ideas and what makes his work so engaging to people. And I think that part of the reason The Secret World is so much fun is because they are just looking at these common urban fantasy, like Vampire the Masquerade or Werewolf the Apocalypse or Stephen King novels or something, for like, how can we take this genre stuff and use it as like, basically, you know, basically when you're making an MMO, you're like, oh my God, I have to write like 2 million words of content for the players.
Yeah.
and so what they're like, let's just take some really good tropey settings and environments, and then let's stitch them all together with interesting quests and characters inside of those places.
Yeah, no, for sure. If I wasn't terminally addicted to Final Fantasy XIV, I'd probably play it, but because it always seemed like a lot of fun to me. But one MMORPG is all I can handle in my life.
Speaking of Final Fantasy XIV, though, that has more than a share of King references inside the quest text.
It sure does. Like, I'm trying to remember some off the top of my head, but I can't remember. I just know I've seen them and done the whole like pointy meme thing about them. Do you remember any off by the top of your head? Because I sure don't.
I don't. Not off the top of my head.
I just remember
groaning at them as I'm playing the game.
That tends to happen. I know I've seen a lot of Dark Tower references there, but
you can't get like Cujo as a mount, no?
You should.
Not a good idea.
I do know that like there's a line where Midgard Stormer, the Dragon King, says like, you've forgotten the face of your lord, so I always thought it was a riff on, oh, you've forgotten the face of your father. So
right, which is a Dark Tower reference.
Yeah, Dark Tower. Yeah. So I always thought that was that, but that's all I can remember.
Also, since I referenced Cooge, Stephen King is working on a Cujo sequel right now, kind of an unexpected sequel.
Really? How can you make a sequel out of Cujo? Poor dog.
It's about like a different animal, I think, this time.
Cats. Do you say a cat? Yeah. I haven't done anything with a crazy cat. Are you kidding me? Oh, dear God, Pet Sanctuary. That cemetery is terrifying.
It's called Rattlesnakes. Excuse me.
Rattlesnakes?
It's called Rattlesnakes.
I'm not
but
sure
it's not about rattlesnakes. That's just the name of the
book. Oh, damn. But actually, my first dog was named Cujo.
Really?
Did
your mother name the family dog?
My dad named him.
Dark, because the movie Cujo messed me up. Have you even seen it? It is good.
I haven't seen the movie. I've read the book. The book is actually one of the saddest books I've ever read. You would think it's scary, which it is, but it has a
really sad ending. It has a super sad ending. Like, the film's ending is not as sad as the book's.
Really? Well, I guess there's a way to make it not as sad, for sure, not without getting really too many spoilers, but yeah. Did either of you play in 1998 Legend of Legaia?
I didn't finish it, but I did start it. And I've also played
There's a mist in it. I think they even call it the mist, right?
That's why I was going to bring it up, because it has a mist in it. And it had like monsters in the mist. And I always, long before I knew that, you know, Stephen King was all that popular in Japan, I thought, this is a weird reference. This can't be coincidental, can it?
It also has really low polygon character models in the battles.
I know. I'm wary of reading too much into misty environments in the 32-bit era.
Yeah, you'd be like, oh, you know,
Superman 64.
You're like Rydia.
Really a reference to the mist.
You're like Rydia and her family. They're all from the mist. No, not really. That's misted here.
Briefly off topic for a second. I know that in Final Fantasy IV, I didn't know this before. You go back to the town of Mist after everything's been burnt to the ground, and you talk to someone who says, yeah, the town just suddenly caught fire one day and we have no idea how it happened. Just picturing Cecil looking at the sky whistling.
Oh, I remember that and being kind of like, you're depressed. Yeah, that's super depressing.
Yeah, that's one of the I'm sorry, as long as we're talking about Final Fantasy XIV, it's one of my favorite changes between the original translation and the new one is that, like, in the original one, it's just like package, and in the retranslation, which is more accurate to the original one, it's like bomb.
Please deliver this bomb to the innocent people in this video. Thank you.
And Cecil's like, I had no idea this is going to happen.
I can't read.
Are we the baddies? I think we are.
Good thing this package can't stop me because I can't read.
So, oh man, how good would like a Dark Tower MMO be? Like,
well, I'll say
popular.
The less that's said about the Dark Tower 2017, the better. However, I am hopeful that Amazon is going to invest in a new Dark Tower series by Flanagan.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll do it right, because he sounds like he wants to do it right. He wants to start like the beginning of the Gunslinger. And like, wouldn't it be great if, you know, someone made a game or games or you know, like a world of games based on the Dark Tower that were actually good.
That's the dream. You know, with Rings of Power, we've seen Amazon is kind of willing to go for like a 4 or 5 season commitment up front. So hopefully they'll do something similar for the Dark. Because you don't want to tell the gunslinger and then be like, the end.
You know, it's funny, Nadia, you mentioning the fact that there was a Mist Adventure game and there was a Dark Half game. And do you guys know about the Dollar Babies thing? Do you know that concept of Dollar Baby? So for 45 years, Stephen King's had a thing called Dollar Babies, where if you're an independent filmmaker and you want to make a non-commercial film, short film or feature film based on one of his stories that hasn't been optioned, you can send him a dollar and you can get the rights to do it. And every year people do it. And there's been lots of interesting adaptations of like his lesser works. And I think maybe Flanagan, like someone started out doing a Dollar Baby and became a real director. Anyway, so it'd be cool if we could try to inspire King to like let indie developers license his games to make indie games. Right? How cool would that be if suddenly people could just start making indie games based on?
I know you mentioned this already, but like I really think that Langoliers would make a really. I think you could do some really interesting.
Oh yeah. Well, I was going to ask. I was like, yeah, like that. That was my choice. I think for like if someone asked me like what Stephen King short story or you know book would you want to make a game? I do have a real weird soft spot for the Langoliers. I would love to play a Langoliers game.
I would make one based on Grandma.
I've never read Grandma. I hear it's really good and
it's great.
Weird.
It's so like a lot of Skeleton Crew, it's great and weird.
So yeah, we've been talking about his novels a lot. Like Stephen King has a lot of good short stories, and they've also been like really influential and option for movies and all that. You mentioned The Body, which is Stand By Me.
Oh yes, of course. That's one we haven't really talked about, which is a very, very big one, especially in Japan. And I don't really understand why. I think it's basically the camaraderie between the four boys. I guess that's a big part of it. But apparently Japan has a boy band based on Stand By Me.
That's Final amazing. Fantasy 15 starts with the song Stand By Me.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
Literally.
And it's about four boys hanging out together. Like, you can't get more on the nose.
Well, I mean, Stand By Me is a fantastic film. I was the right age. I saw it in the theater. It inspired me and my friends to go walk across a rail bridge and risk our lives to be like that movie. And
did you find dead bodies?
No, we didn't. I wanted to. But yeah, I think Stand By Me is incredibly influential to all kinds of media.
I saw someone mention, actually, and I didn't even think about this, but anime in general apparently has a lot of scenes with railroad tracks for that specific reason.
Yeah.
I never even thought about that, but I guess it's true. I know that, like, as you said, just thinking about Stand By Me and the opening for Final Fantasy 15. Wasn't that Florence and the Machine?
It was. It was Florence and the Machine covering Stand By Me. Yeah.
Well, at least it didn't pay for Frank Sinatra. Like,
no, I think it's cool they got a cover.
I think that's amazing, but I'm looking at it like, do you guys, how much did that cost you? Just out of curiosity.
A lot.
But of course, Stand By Me is... yeah. Stand By Me is worth mentioning because for the early Pokemon games, at least, that's how many of them start out. You check the TV and you see Stand By Me, the movie playing, and I always thought that was a neat touch. Now, as we wrap up here, actually, one that I want to bring up, and we haven't, and shame on us, is Half-Life. Again, it's The Mist. Instead of the Arrowhead Project, you have Black Mesa. It's Valve has come out and said basically Half-Life is The Mist.
For sure. So Mark Laidlaw, the lead writer on Half-Life, he's also a horror writer. And I think he's been Bram Stoker nominated, amongst other things. So there's no... I mean, Half-Life is a horror game. We often think of it as like a science fiction game or like a shooter type game. But like when you look at the plot of Half-Life, like it is straight up beings from another world, a noble cosmic horror.
Yeah, like monster closets stuff. Yeah.
Anyone who says that Half-Life isn't a horror or Half-Life 2, I challenge them to go into a dark, watery area with the failing flashlight where the headcrabs are known to roam and come back and tell me it's not a horror game.
Dr. Breen, too, in Half-Life 2, I think is a really good Kingian villain in terms of kind of, you know, I mean, this is like we were talking about the Stand, like Randall Flagg, the Man in Black. Like, he's not the big bad. Like, he's the face and the instrument of the Crimson King. He is the protagonist's nemesis because he is a person. That's what's so amazing to me about the Dark Tower and about the Man in Black. It's like he's not a cosmic threat. Okay, he's just
you haven't read the end, but at the end, like, Flag isn't even like the next to big bad. He's like the third or fourth down the line. You know, it's like, which is kind of amazing. He kind of just goes out like a chump. And yeah.
But Breen reminds me of him a lot in that, like, he's the guy who's on the TV. He's the guy who's talking to you. He's the guy you're going after. He doesn't matter at all, like, in the grand scheme of things. But you know, he's such a compelling villain, and you really hate him so much that you ignore the fact that he is actually not, he is not the instrument of your demise and your travails. He is just this guy who's in front of you, who you fixate on.
He's the guy. He is, as you said, kind of the face of something much worse is behind him. And you always get that impression when you read about him, but he is definitely the face. Like, I think he's described in Eyes of the Dragon as someone who just wants the power to make trouble. Doesn't want money, doesn't want women, doesn't want anything, just wants to make trouble. And that's what he does, at least in Eyes of the Dragon. Like, he stirs up a whole bunch of revolutions and takes off. That's what he does.
Throughout most of his appearances, he's kind of like this charming anti-hero who you're almost rooting for, which, you know, I think you ultimately... Yeah, he's so charismatic, and I think ultimately, like, he's nothing in the grand scale of the evil in Stephen King's universe.
No, but he doesn't have to be. He sometimes all you need is a shit disturber, and that's all it takes.
Well, and even, like, you know, since we've spoiled so much, like, the big bad, the Crimson King, is kind of a nothing at the end too. And I think, like, the real villain in Dark Tower, is the hero's kind of quest, his blindness, because all he cares about is the MacGuffin. All he cares about is his adventure and the realization of his party that he will sacrifice them to get what he needs. And it's a really interesting story. I highly recommend it to all the listeners of Retronauts.
That does sound very good, Amy.
When you mentioned that, Shane, it makes me think about Roland as like a... So there's been a lot of, like, interesting kind of deconstructions of, like, the RPG hero in terms of, like, okay, but who is this asshole who thinks that he's the chosen one and goes into people's houses and smashes their...
I'm just looking through all your drawers and smashing your pots. Don't mind me.
But you know, because they're like, oh, well, they're the hero. They can do that, whatever. And it's like, when you look at Roland a little bit, like, he kind of has a little bit of that to him, and that, you know, you're like, well, he's the good guy. This story's about him. He's great. But then when you kind of look a little bit deeper at, like, what he's willing to give up and to railroad in pursuit of his quest, you know, it's not even that he's not noble. It's just that you've maybe been misreading his motivations, because you've been assigning heroic motivations to what is actually a story of revenge.
So Dark Tower is Undertale the book.
And in that first book in The Gunslinger, King shows you what Roland will sacrifice, and you don't forget that, you know, I think we should dream of Dark Tower games. I think that would be the ultimate influence of King, because it is his legacy to the true fans. I think, you know, all the big name books, the Shinings, those would be the ones that ultimately he's remembered for. But if you really get into what he was trying to say, I think it is the Dark Tower.
As long as we're talking, I'm sorry, I know we're trying to wrap up, but, like, have I told you about, like, I think that, like, the Dark Tower and Final Fantasy are actually very similar series in terms of their kind of, like, mixture of fantasy and science fiction. Kind of an anything goes at, like, the Final Fantasies aren't all connected to each other, but I think tonally they have the same sort of, like, I will just throw whatever I want into this narrative.
14 is that basically. It's just them throwing everything Final Fantasy into one.
14 is the Dark Tower of Final Fantasy.
Like, right. Really, but by 6, I think by 6 they were prepared to branch out in new directions and post-apocalyptic directions and science fiction directions, and they never really looked back. And even 4 has sci-fi. I mean, you're right. Yeah, like, it's always been broad.
You do go to the moon, just kind of sci-fi-y and underground.
And you start as anti-heroes in that, too. So, yeah. And that was the 80s. So, yeah. Man, these things are old. Are we old? We're old.
I think we might be old. I'm sorry to break it to y'all. But any closing thoughts, basically, on King's influence in games? And, you kind of indicated where you want to see it go, e.g. a Dark Tower game series.
And I think all the people making video games now pretty much have been influenced by King, even if they aren't active King fans. It's such a part of the fabric of culture. I mean, like, the average child is afraid of clowns now. When we were kids, like, our parents thought circuses and clowns were great. And, like, when I was a little kid, I had a clown stuff in my room, and I had a clown painting and clown lamp. And I was like, 30 years after it, no child is going to have a clown.
Clowns are like the only thing that my daughter is afraid of.
I don't blame her.
Thanks, Pennywise.
Yeah. It's like
and John Wayne Gacy.
Never seen and John Wayne clown. Gacy. She does not understand the idea of a clown that is not a horror clown.
I actually love there was a line from Nintendo about how they brought in that clown character for ARMS. I can't remember her name. And they were just like surprised when America just started screaming as a collective. And they realized America's scared of clowns. This gives us power. And they actually said, this gives us power.
Yeah. Wasn't it a sexy clown? I don't remember. Or was that?
No. Twintel is a sexy one. The clown. Oh, that people will find anything sexy these days. What am I saying?
I completely memory hold ARMS. It took like a full 45 seconds for me to like pull that out of the memory hole. So thank you for bringing that game up. You were like, I was playing some Nintendo Land the other day and,
Nintendo Land deserved better though, I think.
Really?
I mean, I'd say ARMS deserves better, but it has that angry, sexy clown. So maybe it doesn't deserve any better, but that is it for this very clowning around clown-centric horror clown episode of Retronauts. If you think this episode is cool, we have a whole lot more like it. Just visit the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts for access to media that's even more nourishing than a field full of weasel-infested corn. I had to actually come up with that one.
Is that from the Children of the Corn? She who walks between the rows?
No, try again. Here's the hint. Weasel infested corn. Weasel infested.
Why are there weasels in the corn?
Why are there weasels in the corn indeed, Shane?
What is that? Is that from the stand?
The stand, the trash can man appears in Mother Abigail's dream.
You're right. Okay. Deep in my brain, I was like, it's from the stand. But you should also watch Stand. The recent Stand to see a terrible trash can man portrayed by Ezra Miller, a trash can man, thumbs down to that.
Ezra Miller. hold that one. Speaking of memory holes. Holy shit.
Well, don't worry. He's coming back as the Flash and you'll have to remember him whether you want to or not.
Oh no.
You don't have to take this. Like everything Shane said, I agree with too. Like King is so influential that he influenced the culture and the culture influenced the games, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, very brief diversion here. Look at Stranger Things. I mean, that was influenced by Silent Hill, which was influenced by King, and everything's kind of going full circle now.
Yeah.
Good times. So support us on Retronauts at the $3 level to receive access to weekly episodes, support us at the $5 level to get episodes a week early, as well as 2 exclusive episodes a month. Support us at the magic number 64 for the opportunity to set a Retronauts topic once every 6 months. As of this recording, there are 2 spots left, so go ahead and snap them up. As for me, I am Nadia Oxford, co-host of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. We talk about RPGs old, new, Eastern, and Western. Support us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod and or follow me on Twitter at Nadia Oxford. I also do a podcast that's under the umbrella called Charlotte and Dropouts, the Final Fantasy XIV podcast. You can hear me here on Retronauts, of course, and I'm on Nadia Oxford. I'm at Nadia Oxford on Twitter. Andrew, why don't you? I don't know if you want to tell us anything about yourself or where we can find you, but if not, that's fine too.
I work in games. I left Twitter after Musk bought it. So if you want to find me, look me up on LinkedIn. I guess that's kind of how I live my life these days, you know. But I am always happy to play games and talk about games, and it's always a pleasure, Nadia.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you too. And Shane, how about you?
I'm regrettably still kind of on the Twitter for now. Not as much, but still there at Shane Watch. And I think this episode has inspired me to even read more King because I have a big stack. I really did buy like 20 Stephen King books during the break, and I need to buy more. And
that's the great thing about King, though, is that you can always find a King book you haven't read.
There's always one out there.
Yeah, I on a plane recently, I read The Colorado Kid, which is like a very random one. Yeah, it's hard-boiled, not that great. I think next up I'm going to do 11-23-63. I think I'm next. Or Under the Dome. I hear that one's good too.
Oh, Under the Dome's going to be good.
Did you read what was the Regulators? Was that the companion piece to Under the Dome?
No, that's those are Regulators and Desperation. And there's some Dark Tower in those too. So. Yeah. Nadia, one day in the distant future, you should read all of The Dark Tower and we should have a sequel to this episode in like
ten
years hence.
I agree. We will. It's like the pact that the Loser Club made. We'll come back when
we'll come back when Pennywise rises from the sewer and talk about this again one day.
So nobody go taking any, fatal showers in the meantime. Or was it a bath? It was a bath. That's right. He killed himself in the bath. But until next time, thank you for listening. And don't go burying your dead kids in other people's gardens. It's not nice. Midnight, where the stars and you.
Lord of sweet romance.